concludes today's Earthwatch tribute to Madiba Nelson Mandela.
Of a brain, we have all seen him standing amidst the surprise. Sometimes a man smiles,
and I
often wonder. You can tell he's a thinker by the faraway look in his eyes. The faraway look in his eyes. A pity for his thoughts could make him richer. His eyes could see what other eyes could not. What is the power of an Napoleon? Not mere power, but magnetism.
And magnetism
is more intelligent than force. Magnetism is more intelligent than
welcome your comments with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York. Up next, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Thank you.
and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and related fields of endeavor. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, sadly, another tribute program. 2 weeks ago, Jack Vance. Still to come, Ian Banks. This morning, Richard Matheson. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons, writer and critic for Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com. And if all goes as planned, this is the third review you're hearing from me this morning. Collect them all.
We're going
to be talking about World War Z, so let's just get a point of terminology straight right off. When I'm talking about revivified corpses with an instinctive, reflexive hunger for the living, I'm going to use the term zombie. There are other terms for them. Some would argue more accurate terms, the Walking Dead, walkers, biters, rotters, snappers, slippers, Denny's customers. I'm sticking with zombies, imprecision be damned, both because it seems to be the most widely comprehended term and also because it's the one I automatically go for. So on to the film. And let me say this, it isn't that World War Z is definitive proof that a film about a zombie outbreak, a phenomenon we always presume is taking place on a global scale, can't be portrayed on that global scale. It does demonstrate that if you're going to try for that, it's not a simple matter of boosting the budget and laying in the CG swarms of ambulatory corpses. The reasons why, we'll get to in a sec. The story at base is pretty simple. The world is succumbing to a zombie plague. Infected people are being overcome with an irrepressible drive to bite the living, who after 12 seconds or so, turn themselves. It's a fast-spreading thing, governments are toppling, society is crumbling, and Brad Pitt plays a former UN troubleshooter sent on a worldwide search for Patient Zero, who it is hoped will hold the key to the cure. For the purposes of the film, worldwide search means South Korea, Israel, and Wales. And the film also tries to trump up some drama with Pitt being torn between his responsibility to his family and his duty as apparently the only man on Earth who can pull off this mission. But it doesn't really amount to much. There is an opportunity here. As I pointed out before, zombie outbreak films don't usually get portrayed on the world stage, so this is an opportunity to see what that would be like. And there's certainly potential in both drama and action in Brad Pitt's visit to an embattled Korean military station, to a fortified Jerusalem, and to a World Health Organization research center in Cardiff. Unfortunately, director Mark Forster doesn't take advantage of the opportunities given him. Shots of attacking zombie hordes that should be dazzling and disturbing are instead confusing and unimpressive. Action sequences too often rely on shaky cam to trump up excitement, which just makes them look lousy, especially in 3D, and the plotting is so heavily dependent on contrivances that Brad Pitt's character comes off less as resilient and resourceful, and more as the luckiest son of a gun on Earth. The grandest irony is that World War Z's final act is based around the film's characters sneaking into a zombie-infested laboratory to retrieve some crucial supplies. And after woefully flawed attempts at epic scale, the film finally finds its footing in a sequence that's intimate, suspenseful, narrows its stakes to ones that matter for the characters on screen, and finally, finally gets us up close and personal with the zombies, who are actually quite nicely conceived combinations of creepy makeup and spastic, reflexive choreography. Here's the major pitfall of treating a zombie outbreak tale from a worldwide perspective. As interesting as is the idea of seeing legions of the Walking Dead flooding the globe, the true power of the zombie genre is the personal one, of placing yourself in the position of looking into the eyes of something both other and not, of battling to push aside every empathetic instinct you have to recognize something that is pure, instinctive hunger. That's something that no swooping CG-enhanced crowd shot can capture. As ambitious as it may be, World War Z discovers that lesson too late and fails because of it. I'm Dan Person. See my daily Here's What's Going On video news updates over at cfqonline.com.
And thank you, Dan. We have two yet unplayed reviews from Dan, but that one was the most au courant, and I thought we would start with that. We also have Man of Steel, but we talked about that. He didn't record that one for me, did he, as a matter of fact? Because he was here live last week, if you were listening. And if you weren't, well, why not? Anyhow, we have, the Will Smith movie and others. But we have, after all of the 5 weeks of not being on the air for the thon, and this problem and that problem and so on and so forth. Pardon me, by the way, while I cue something up. I have any number of interviews. Yes, the second one.
I prefer the first one.
Yeah, okay, fine. Do you think they spell the number?
I don't know. I got a great version of it, but it's probably not here.
Well, yeah, but I mean, let's just see. Here's the artist, okay? So let's see. Here's the album. There it is.
Okay.
There it is. And it's not a live version. We haven't said a thing. Yeah, they're both good. Well, you know, depending on how.
The first one, I told you.
But that's 10 minutes long. The story. The reason I'm not doing Duel is because Duel would take about 75 minutes.
Wow.
I'm already too late on it.
Okay, well, you better get practice.
Yeah, well, this one's about 45 minutes. I have recorded interviews with Sharon Lee and Steve Miller, with Moira Crone, who is just a brilliant, brilliant writer, Tom Doyle, whose first collection of short stories is out, and he made a topical, at the time, announcement about a movie series. I'm going to be recording an interview with Kate Elliott next Tuesday. I forgot to bring information about next Tuesday, but I can tell you all about it off the top of my head. But I'll do that in just a moment. But, I mean, it's absolutely horrible and miserable what's going on. In fact, I got an email from Andrew Porter. Let's see if I can. I have a device here. My little phone here will let me get into my email, and then I can read you this rather distressing message that Andy Porter sent out, which is basically about, well, how many obits we've had to deal with in the last year. Helps if you spell it correctly, Freund. Okay, while I'm doing this, while I'm looking for Andrew's message, Let me tell you, Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, July 2nd, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, hosted by me, produced by me for that matter, will feature two people from far away places. The first one is the debut of a new writer who's been around for years, by the name of E.C. Ambrose. And she has a medieval fantasy novel that involves some very bizarre, fun things. And I'll tell you how to find out more about this in a moment. The other person is a major bestseller. Her name is Kate Elliott. Oh, and E.C. Andrews will be coming down from Massachusetts, whereas Kate Elliott is going to be coming all the way across from Hawaii, where she paddles canoes and stuff like that. I kid you not, makes dugouts, and you look at her webpage, and it's rather amazing what she does. So, this is free admission with donations requested at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, held at the SGDA, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, at 138 Sullivan Street. That's between Prince and Houston. For more information, just go to my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com. Very old-looking site, because it has a very old design. The site's 20 years old, almost. 19 years old. And then you go to the link that says New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and then you will see the last reading on there, the July 2nd reading. You click on that, and all the information and interactive maps and bios of all the writers and what they've read and written, rather, and stuff like that will all be there. So look that up. I hope you are there. Okay, Andy Porter, who used to put out SF Chronicle and stuff like that, writes about something. He says he has a list here of the SF fantasy horror genre obituaries that he sent out to his list of usual suspects. That includes me, since the beginning of May 2012. Individually, they were bad enough. Listed like this, it's like some mass culling of our genres. The first reference to Robert A. Heinlein's story, The Year of the Jackpot, is a pivotal number of deaths in our community, was in 1958. That wasn't repeated until 1968, when another group of well-known fans and pros died. But this year tops those by far. This is truly depressing, almost frightening in the width and breadth of the loss to our increasingly fragile universe. And, of course, add to that, in the last month, having lost three members of the WBAI family. In the last year alone, Leo Dillon, Ray Bradbury, Jim Young, who was a Minneapolis writer who was on this program, Harry Harrison, who's been on this program, Josepha Sherman, Danny Lieberman, who's never on our air but is a good friend of Ken Gale's, myself, and other people at WBAI. Stephen Utley, well-known writer. Ann Jordan. Richard Geis, who was on KPFA for some years ago. Jan Howard Finder, who's a well-known fan. Paul Williams, this is the man who created Crawdaddy magazine and invented the term and concept of fanzine for both his science fiction and rock zines that he wrote. That's a term that he coined, zine. Everybody uses it now. Nobody knows where it came from. It came from Paul Williams, who was the executor of both Philip K. Dick and Theodore Sturgeon's estate, then was in a bicycle accident, and he was fine for about 2 months, and then during which we did an interview, by the way, and then basically totally collapsed and was everything but brain dead for something like, 12 years or so, confined to a bed, just linked into equipment. And that was a tragic, tragic story. Roger Ebert, the critic and previously science fiction fan. Nick Pallotta, who had been on this program. Andy Offit, Andrew J. Offit. Richard Ballantyne, as in Son of Ballantyne Books. Jack Vance, who we dealt with on this show 2 weeks ago. Ian M. Banks, brilliant writer. We're going to have to do a show for him. Park Godwin, who was a fine fantasy writer. And about 3 days ago, Richard Matheson. Now, if you don't know the work of Richard Matheson, actually, yes, you do. Going to Wikipedia, just looking at the section on novels before adaptations. I asked Max, I wasn't feeling well. I'm not feeling well tonight. So I apologize in advance for the reading that is yet to come. But I called Max Schmid and said, you know, get me some Richard Matheson radio dramas.
Oh,
Richard Matheson, there must be hundreds of radio dramas. He's written everything. Not a one. There were some Twilight Zone radio dramas, which are, I don't know what, about 8 years old or something, that are available on Audible.com, but no classic radio dramas. This from a man who wrote no less than about 16 episodes of The Twilight Zone and all that, but he starts in the TV era, even though he wrote novels earlier. He wrote the novel I Am Legend, which was filmed as The Last Man on Earth, The Omega Man, I Am Omega, and I Am Legend. Four films of that one. The Shrinking Man, which was filmed as The Incredible Shrinking Man, and then redone as The Incredible Shrinking Woman. A Stir of Echoes, also a movie. Ride the Nightmare, which was turned into an Alfred Hitchcock episode, and a movie called Cold Sweat. The Beardless Warriors, filmed as Young Warriors. The Comedy of Terrors, Hell House, filmed twice as The Legend of Hell House. What Dreams May Come. Blah, blah, blah. I'm skipping. He was so prolific. Born of Man and Woman, Third from the Sun. Clothes Make the Man, something called The Thing. You might have heard of it. It was an adaptation, of course, of John W. Campbell, but I've heard Don Stewart. What was the name Campbell wrote that under? Whatever. The Thing. Advance Notice. Burn, Witch, Burn, he wrote based on the novel by Fritz Leiber. Excellent grade B movie. Excellent film. Death Ship. Twilight Zone. Little Girl Lost. Mother by Protest. Dance of the Dead was a recent thing on Masters of Horror. The Doll That Does Everything. Miss Stardust. The Funeral. That was on Night Gallery. Not a Twilight Zone for a change. Still Rod Serling. Steel, which was a Twilight Zone episode and came out a year and a half ago as Real Steel, starring Hugh Jackman. Button Button, which came out as the movie The Box. Mute. You probably remember that Twilight Zone episode with Agnes Moorehead. Some of these are under pseudonyms. He wrote frequently as Logan Swanson. The likeness of Julie was made into Julie in the TV film Trilogy of Terror. Deus Ex Machina, Prey, By Appointment Only, Duel. Steven Spielberg's first movie, Duel. Great, great short story, and one that I originally wanted to read on the air tonight, but that would take more than the 90 minutes I've got. I did it on Hour of the Wolf before, when Hour of the Wolf was a 2-hour show, but we don't have the time for that tonight. The Doll, which was an Amazing Stories episode. Oh, God, just the how many collections? I can't count that. Let's see. About 20 collections. How many movies? 2, 4, 6, 8. Tales of Terror, The Raven, The Comedy of Terrors. The Devil Rides Out, Twilight Zone movie, What Dreams May Come, The Box, Real Steel, television. We don't have time for me to even count what he's written for television, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Scream of the Wolf, not Howard the Wolf, Scream of the Wolf. The Martian Chronicles. Remember that TV version starring Rock Hudson and various people? He wrote that. And on top of all that, he was a nice guy. He was a pivotal guy. He's somebody who was paid tribute years ago by people like Stephen King and Ray Bradbury and so forth. I am going to read or attempt to read one of his seminal short stories. It's been a Twilight Zone twice. It was in the original Twilight Zone, starring William Shatner. And it was in the Twilight Zone movie, starring John Lithgow. The name of the story, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, by Richard Matheson. Seatbelt, please, said the stewardess cheerfully as she passed him. Almost as she spoke, the sign above the archway which led to the forward compartment all lit up, the fastened seatbelt with below its attendant caution, no smoking. Drawing in a deep lungful, Wilson exhaled it in bursts, then pressed the cigarette into the armrest tray with irritable, stabbing motions. Outside, one of the engines coughed monstrously, spewing out a cloud of fume which fragmented into the night air. The fuselage began to shudder, and Wilson, glancing through the window, saw the exhaust of flame jetting whitely from the engine's nacelle. The second engine coughed, then roared, its propeller instantly a blur of revolution. With a tense submissiveness, Wilson fastened the belt across his lap. Now all the engines were running, and Wilson's head throbbed in unison with the fuselage. He sat rigidly, staring at the seat ahead as the DC-7 taxied across the apron, heating the night with the thundering blast of its exhausts. At the edge of the runway, it halted. Wilson looked out through the window at the leviathan glitter of the terminal. By late morning, he thought, showered and cleanly dressed, he would be sitting in the office of one more contact, discussing one more specious deal near the net result of which would not add one jot of meaning to the history of mankind. It was all so damned, Wilson gasped, as the engines began their warm-up race preparatory to takeoff. The sound, already loud, became deafening, waves of sound that crashed against Wilson's ears like club blows. He opened his mouth as if to let it drain. His eyes took on the glaze of a suffering man, his hands drew in like tensing claws. He started, legs retracting, as he felt a touch on his arm. Jerking aside his head, he saw the stewardess who had met him at the door. She was smiling down at him. "Are you all right?" He barely made out her words. Wilson pressed his lips together and agitated his hand at her as if pushing her away. Her smile flared into excess brightness, then fell as she turned and moved away. The plane began to move, at first lethargically, like some behemoth struggling to overthrow the pull of its own weight. Then, with more speed, forcing off the drag of friction, Wilson, turning to the window, saw the dark runway rushing by faster and faster. On the wing edge, there was a mechanical whining as the flaps descended. Then, imperceptibly, the giant wheels lost contact with the ground. The earth began to fall away. Trees flashed underneath, buildings, the darting quicksilver of car lights. The DC-7 banked slowly to the right, pulling itself upward towards the frosty glitter of the stars. Finally, it leveled off, and the engine seemed to stop until Wilson's adjusting ear caught the murmur of their cruising speed. A moment of relief slackened his muscles, imparting a sense of well-being. Then it was gone. Wilson sat immobile, staring at the no-smoking sign until it winked out, then quickly lit a cigarette. Reaching into the seat back pocket in front of him, he slid free his newspaper. As usual, the world was in a state similar to his. Friction in diplomatic circles, earthquakes, gunfire, murder, rape, tornadoes and collisions, business conflicts, gangsterism. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, thought Arthur Jeffrey Wilson. 15 minutes later, he tossed the paper aside. His stomach felt awful. He glanced up at the signs beside the two laboratories, both illuminated, red, occupied. He pressed out his third cigarette since takeoff, and turning off the overhead light, stared out the window. Along the cabin's length, people were already flicking out their lights and reclining their chains for sleep. Wilson glanced at his watch. 11:20. He blew out tired breath. As he'd anticipated, the pills that he had taken before boarding had not done a bit of good. He stood abruptly as the woman came out of the laboratory, and, snatching up his bag, he started down the aisle. His system, as expected, gave no cooperation. Wilson stood with a tired moan and adjusted his clothing. Having washed his hands and face, he removed the toilet kit from his bag and squeezed a filament of paste across his toothbrush. As he brushed, one hand braced for support against the cold bulkhead, he looked out through the port. Feet away was the pale blue of the inboard propeller. Wilson visualized what would happen if it were to tear loose and, like a tri-bladed cleaver, come slicing in at him. There was a sudden depression in his stomach. Wilson swallowed instinctively and got some paste-stained saliva down his throat. Gagging, he turned, spat into the sink, then, hastily, washed out his mouth and took a drink. Dear God, if only he could have gone by train, had his own compartment, taken a casual stroll to the club car, settled down in an easy chair with a drink and a magazine. But there was no such time or fortune in this world. He was about to put the toilet kit away when his gaze caught on the oilskin envelope in the bag. He hesitated, then, setting the small briefcase on the sink, drew out the envelope and undid it on his lap. He sat staring at the oil-gloss symmetry of the pistol. He carried it around with him for almost a year now. Originally, when he thought about it, it was in terms of money carried, protection from hold-up, safety from teenage gangs in the cities he had to attend. Yet, far beneath, he had always known there was no valid reason except one. A reason he thought more of every day, and how simple it would be. Here. Now. Wilson shut his eyes and swallowed quickly. He could still taste the toothpaste in his mouth, a faint nettling of peppermint on the buds. He sat heavily in the throbbing chill of the laboratory, the oily gun resting in his hands, until quite suddenly he began to shiver without control. God, let me go, his mind cried out abruptly. Let me go, let me go, he barely recognized the whimpering in his ears. Abruptly, Wilson sat erect. Lips pressed together, he rewrapped the pistol and thrust it into his bag, putting the briefcase on top of it, zipping the bag shut. Standing, he opened the door and stepped outside, hurrying to his seat and sitting down, sliding the overnight bag precisely into place. He indented the armrest button and pushed himself back. He was a businessman, and there was business to be conducted on the morrow. It was as simple as that. The body needed sleep. He would give it sleep. 20 minutes later, Wilson reached down slowly and depressed the button, sitting up with the chair, his face a mask of vanquished acceptance. Why fight it? He thought. It was obvious he was going to stay awake, so that was that. He had finished half of the crossword puzzle before he let the paper drop to his lap. His eyes were too tired. Sitting up, he rotated his shoulders, stretching the muscles of his back. Now what? He thought. He didn't want to read. He couldn't sleep. And there were still, he checked his watch, 7 to 8 hours left before L.A. was reached. How was he to spend them? He looked along the cabin and saw that, except for a single passenger in the forward compartment, everyone was asleep. A sudden overwhelming fury filled him, and he wanted to scream, to throw something, to hit somebody. Teeth jammed together so rabidly it hurt his jaws. Wilson shoved aside the curtains with a spastic hand and stared out murderously through the window. Outside, he saw the wing lights blinking off and on, the lurid flashes of exhaust from the engine cowlings. Here he was, he thought, 20,000 feet above the earth, trapped in a howling shell of death, moving toward the polar night, toward... Wilson twitched as lightning bleached the sky, washing its false daylight across the wing. He swallowed. Was there going to be a storm? The thought of rain and heavy winds, the plane as a chip in the sea of sky, was not a pleasant one. Wilson was a bad flyer. Excess motion always made him ill. Maybe he should have taken another few Dramamines to be on the safe side, and naturally his seat was next to the emergency door. He thought about opening, accidentally, about himself sucked from the plane, falling, screaming. Wilson blinked and shook his head. There was a faint tingling at the back of his neck as he pressed close to the window and stared out. He sat there, motionless, squinting. He could have sworn. Suddenly, his stomach muscles jerked in violently, and he felt his eyes strain forward. There was something crawling on the wing. Wilson felt a sudden nauseous tremor in his stomach. Dear God, had some dog or cat crawled onto the plane before takeoff and in some way managed to hold on? It was a sickening thought. The poor animal would be deranged with terror. Yet how, on the smooth, wind-blasted surface, could it possibly discover gripping places? Surely that was impossible. Perhaps, after all, it was only a bird or... The lightning flared, and Wilson saw that it was a man. He couldn't move. Stupefied, he watched the black form crawling down the wing. Impossible. Somewhere, cased in layers of shock, a voice declared itself that Wilson did not hear. He was conscious of nothing but the titanic, almost muscle-tearing leap of his heart and of the man outside. Suddenly, like ice-filled water thrown across him, there was a reaction. His mind sprang for the shelter of explanation. A mechanic had, through some incredible oversight, been taken up with a ship and had managed to cling to it, even though the wind had torn his clothes away, even though the air was thin and close to freezing. Wilson gave himself no time for refutation. Jarring to his feet, he shouted, "Stewardess! Stewardess!" His voice a hollow, ringing sound in the cabin. He pushed the button for her with a jabbing finger. "Stewardess!" She came running down the aisle, her face tightened with alarm. When she saw the look on his face, she stiffened in her tracks. There's a man out there! A man!" cried Wilson. "What?" Skin constricted on her cheeks, around her eyes. "Look! Look!" Handshaking, Wilson dropped back into his seat and pointed out the window. "He's crawling on the..." The words ended with a choking rattle in his throat. There was nothing on the wing. Wilson sat there trembling for a moment before he turned back. He looked at the reflection of the stewardess on the window. There was a blank expression on her face. At last he turned and looked up at her. He saw her red lips part as though she meant to speak, but she said nothing, only placing the lips together again and swallowing. An attempted smile distended briefly at her features.
I'm sorry, Wilson said. It must have been a..."
He stopped as though the sentence were completed. Across the aisle, a teenage girl was gaping at him with sleepy curiosity. The stewardess cleared her throat.
Can I get you anything?" she asked.
"A glass of water," Wilson said. The stewardess turned and moved back up the aisle. Wilson sucked in a long breath of air and turned away from the young girl's scrutiny. He felt the same. That was the thing that shocked him the most. Where were the visions, the cries, the pummeling fists on temples, the tearing out of hair? Abruptly, he closed his eyes. There had been a man, he thought. There had actually been a man. That's why he felt the same, and yet... there couldn't have been. He knew that clearly. Wilson sat with his eyes closed, wondering what Jacqueline would be doing now if she were in the seat beside him.
Would she be silent, shocked beyond speaking? Or would she, in the more accepted manner, be fluttering around him, smiling, chattering, pretending that she hadn't seen? What would his sons think? Wilson felt a dry sob threatening in his chest. Oh, God! Here's your water, sir. Twitching sharply, Wilson opened his eyes. Would you like a blanket? Inquired the stewardess. No, he shook his head. Thank you, he added, wondering why he was being so polite. If you need anything, just ring, she said. Wilson nodded. Behind him, as he sat with the untouched cup of water in his hand, he heard the muted voices of the stewardess and one of the passengers. Wilson tightened with resentment. Abruptly, he reached down and, careful not to spill the water, pulled out the overnight bag. Unzipping it, he removed the box of sleeping capsules and washed two of them down. Crumpling the empty cup, he pushed it into the seat pocket in front of him. Then, not looking, slid the curtains shut. There. Ended. One hallucination didn't make insanity. Wilson turned onto his right side and tried to set himself against the fitful motion of the ship. He had to forget about this. That was the most important thing. He must not dwell on it. Unexpectedly, he found a wry smile forming on his lips. Well, by God, no one could accuse him of mundane hallucinations, anyway. When he went at it, he did a royal job. A naked man crawling down a DC-7's wing at 20,000 feet. There was a chimera worthy of the noblest lunatic. The humor ended quickly. Wilson felt chilled. It had been so clear, so vivid. How could the eye see such a thing when it did not exist? How could what was in his mind make the physical act of seeing work to its purpose so completely? He hadn't been groggy, in a daze, nor had it been a shapeless, gauzy vision. It had been sharply three-dimensional, fully a part of the things he saw, which he knew were real. That was the frightening part of it. It had not been dreamlike in the least. He had looked at the wing and... Impulsively, Wilson drew aside the curtain. He did not know immediately if he would survive. It seemed as if all the contents of his chest and stomach were bloating horribly, the excess pushing up into his throat and head, choking away breath, pressing out his eyes, imprisoned in the swollen mess, his heart pulsed strickenly, threatening to burst its case as Wilson sat, paralyzed. Inches away, separated from him by the thickness of a piece of glass, the man was staring at him. It was a hideously malignant face, a face not human. Its skin was grimy, of a wide-pored coarseness, its nose a squat, discolored lump, its lips misshapen, cracked, forced apart by the teeth of grotesque size and crookedness, its eyes recessed and small, unblinking, all framed by shaggy, tangled hair which sprouted, too, in furry tufts from the man's ears and nose, bird-like, down across his cheeks. Wilson sat riven to his chair, incapable of response. Time stopped and lost its meaning. Function and analysis ceased. All were frozen in an ice of shock. Only the beat of heart went on alone, a frantic leaping in the darkness. Wilson could not so much as blink. Dull-eyed, breathless, he returned the creature's vacant stare. Abruptly then he closed his eyes and his mind, rid of the sight, broke free. It isn't there, he thought. He pressed his teeth together, breath quavering in his nostrils. It wasn't there. It simply was not there. Clutching at the armrest with pale knuckled fingers, Wilson braced himself. There is no man out there, he told himself. It was impossible that there should be a man out there crouching on the wing looking at him. He opened his eyes to shrink against the seat back with a gagging inhalation. Not only was the man still there, but he was grinning. Wilson turned his fingers in and dug the nails into his palms until pain flared. He kept it there until there was no doubt in his mind that he was fully conscious. Then, slowly, arm quivering and numb, Wilson reached up for the button which would summon the stewardess. He would not make the same mistake again, cry out, leap up to his feet, alarm the creature into flight. He kept reaching upward, a tremor of aghast excitement in his muscles now, because the man was watching him, the small eyes shifting with the movement of his arm. He pressed the button carefully, once, twice. "Now come," he thought. "Come with your objective eyes and see what I see, but hurry!" In the rear of the cabin, he heard a curtain being drawn aside, and suddenly his body stiffened. The man had turned his Caliban head to look in that direction. Paralyzed, Wilson stared at him. "Hurry," he thought, "for God's sake, hurry!" It was over in a second. The man's eyes shifted back to Wilson, across his lips a smile of monstrous cunning. Then with a leap, he was gone.
"Yes, sir."
For a moment, Wilson suffered the fullest anguish of madness. His gaze kept jumping from the spot where the man had stood to the stewardess's questioning face, then back again. Back to the stewardess, to the wing, to the stewardess. His breath caught, his eyes stark with dismay.
"What is it?" asked the stewardess.
It was the look on her face that did it. Wilson closed a vice on his emotions. She couldn't possibly believe him. He realized it in an instant.
I'm sorry,
he faltered. He swallowed so dryly, it made a clicking noise in his throat.
It's nothing. I apologize.
The stewardess obviously didn't know what to say. She kept leaning against the erratic yawing of the ship, one hand holding on to the back of the seat behind Wilson's, the other stirring limply along the seam of her skirt. Her lips were parted slightly, as if she meant to speak, but could not find the words.
"Well," she said finally and cleared her throat, "if you need anything..."
Yes, thank you.
Are we going into a storm?"
The stewardess smiled hastily. "Just a small one," she said. "Nothing to worry about." Wilson nodded with little twitching movements. Then, as the stewardess turned away, breathed in suddenly, his nostrils flaring. He felt certain that she already thought him mad, but didn't know what to do about it, because in her course of training there had been no instruction on the handling of passengers who thought that they saw small men crouching on the wing.
"What?"
Wilson turned his head abruptly and looked outside. He stared at the dark rise of the wing, the spouting flare of the exhausts, the blinking lights. He'd seen the man. To that he would swear. How could he be completely aware of everything around him, be in all ways sane, and still imagine such a thing? Was it logical that the mind, in giving way, should, instead of distorting all reality, insert, with a still intact arrangement of details, one extraneous sight? No. Not logical at all.
Suddenly, Wilson thought about war, about the newspaper stories which recounted the alleged existence of creatures in the sky who plagued the Allied pilots in their duties. They called them gremlins, he remembered. Were there actually such beings? Did they truly exist up here, never falling, riding on the wind, apparently of bulk and weight, yet impervious to gravity? He was thinking that when the man appeared again. One second the wing was empty, the next, with an arcing descent, the man came jumping down to it. There seemed no impact. He landed almost fragilely, short, hairy arms outstretched as if for balance. Wilson tensed. Yes, there was knowledge in his look. The man, was he to think of it as a man? Somehow understood that he had tricked Wilson into calling his stewardess in vain. Wilson felt himself tremble with alarm. How could he prove the man's existence to others? He looked about desperately. That girl across the aisle.
If he spoke to her softly, woke her up, would she be able to? No. The man would jump away before she could see, probably to the top of the fuselage where no one could see him, not even the pilots in their cockpit. Wilson felt a sudden burst of self-condemnation that he had not gotten that camera Walter had asked for. Dear Lord, he thought, to be able to take a picture of the man. He leaned in close to the window. What was the man doing? Abruptly, darkness seemed to leap away as the wing was chalked with lightning. Wilson saw. Like an inquisitive child, the man was squatted on the hitching wing edge, stretching out his right hand towards one of the whirling propellers. As Wilson watched, fascinatedly appalled, the man's hand drew closed and closer to the blurring gyre until suddenly it jerked away and the man's lips twitched back in a soundless cry. He'd lost a finger, Wilson thought. But immediately the man reached forward again, gnarled finger extended, the picture of some monstrous infant trying to capture the spin of a fan blade. If it had not been so hideously out of place, it would have been amusing, for, objectively seen, the man, at that moment, was a comic sight, a fairy tale troll somehow come to life, wind whipping at the hair across his head and body, all of his attention centered on the turn of the propeller. How could this be madness? Wilson suddenly thought. What self-revelation could this farcical little horror possibly bestow on him? Again and again, as Wilson watched, the man reached forward. Again and again, jerked back his fingers, sometimes actually putting them in his mouth as if to cool them. And always, apparently checking, he kept glancing back across at his shoulder, looking at Wilson. He knows, thought Wilson, knows that this is a game between us. If I'm able to get someone else to see him, then he loses. If I'm the only witness, then he wins. The sense of faint amusement was gone now. Wilson clenched his teeth. Why the hell didn't the pilot see? Now the man, no longer interested in the propeller, was settling himself across the engine, cowling like a man astride a bucking horse. Wilson stared at him. Abruptly, a shudder plaited down his back. The little man was picking at the plates that sheathed the engine, trying to get the nails beneath them. Impulsively, Wilson reached up and pressed the button for the stewardess. In the rear of the cabin, he heard her coming, and for a second thought he'd fooled the man who seemed absorbed with his efforts. At the last moment, however, just before the stewardess arrived, the man glanced over at Wilson. Then, like a marionette jerked upward from its stage by wires, he was flying up into the air. Yes? She looked at him apprehensively. Would you sit down, please? He asked. She hesitated. Well, I... Please. She sat down gingerly on the seat beside his. What is it, Mr. Wilson? She asked. He braced himself. That man is still outside, he said. The stewardess stared at him. The reason I am telling you this, Wilson hurried on, is that he's starting to tamper with one of the engines. She turned her eyes instinctively towards the window. No, don't look. He isn't there now. He cleared his throat viscidly. He jumps away whenever you come here. A sudden nausea gripped him as he realized what she must be thinking, as he realized what he himself would be thinking if someone told him such a story. A wave of dizziness seemed to pass across him, and he thought, I am going mad. The point is this, he said, fighting off the thought. If I am not imagining the thing, the ship is in danger. Yes, she said. I know, he said. You think I've lost my mind? Of course not, she said. All I ask is this, he said, struggling against the rise of anger. Just tell the pilots what I've said. Ask them to keep an eye on the wings. If they see nothing, all right. But if they do... The stewardess sat there quietly, looking at him. Wilson's hands curled into fists that trembled in his lap.
"Well?" he asked.
She pushed to her feet. "I'll tell them," she said. Turning away, she moved along the aisle with a movement that was, to Wilson, poorly contrived, too fast to be normal, yet clearly held back, as if to reassure him that she wasn't fleeing. He felt his stomach churning as he looked out the wing again. Abruptly, the man appeared again, landing on the wing like some grotesque ballet dancer. Wilson watched him as he set to work again, straddling the engine casing with his thick, bare legs and picking at the plates. Well, what was there to be so concerned about, thought Wilson. That miserable creature couldn't pry up rivets with his fingernails. Actually, it didn't matter if the pilot saw him or not, at least as far as the safety of the plane was concerned. As for his own personal reasons, it was at that moment that the man pried up one edge of a plate. Wilson gasped. "Here, quickly!" he shouted, noticing up ahead the stewardess and the pilot coming up through the cockpit doorway. The pilot's eyes jerked up to look at Wilson. Then abruptly, he was pushing past the stewardess and lurching up the aisle. "Hurry!" Wilson cried. He glanced out the window in time to see the man go leaping upward. Well, that didn't matter now. There would be evidence. "What's going on?" the pilot asked, stopping breathlessly beside his seat. "He's torn up one of the engine plates," said Wilson in a shaking voice.
"He has what?"
"The man outside! I'm telling you that he's..."
"Mr. Wilson, please keep your voice down," ordered the pilot. Wilson's jaw went slack.
"I don't know what's going on here," said the pilot, "but will you look?" shouted Wilson.
"Mr. Wilson, I am warning you, for God's sake!"
Wilson swallowed quickly, trying to repress the blinding rage he felt. Abruptly, he pushed back against his seat and pointed at the window with a palsied hand. "Will you, for God's sake, just look!"
Drawing in an agitated breath, the pilot bent over. In a moment, his gaze shifted coldly to Wilson's.
"Well?" he asked.
Wilson jerked his head around. The plates were in their normal position.
"Oh, now. Now, wait," he said before the dread could come. "I saw him pry that plate up."
"Mr. Wilson, if you don't..." "I said I saw him pry it up," said Wilson.
The pilot stood there, looking at him in the same withdrawn, almost aghast way as the stewardess had. Wilson shuddered violently. "Listen, I saw him!" The sudden break in his voice appalled him. In a second, the pilot was down beside him. "Mr. Wilson, please. All right, you saw him. But please remember there are other people aboard and we mustn't alarm them."
Wilson was too shaken to understand at first.
You mean you've seen him then?"
"Of course," the pilot said, "but we don't want to frighten the passengers. You can understand that."
Well, of course. I don't want to."
Wilson felt a spastic coiling in his groin and lower stomach. Suddenly he pressed his lips together and looked at the pilot with malevolent eyes.
"I understand," he said. "The thing we have to remember," began the pilot.
"We can stop now," said Wilson.
"Sir?"
Wilson shuddered.
"Get out of here," he said. "Mr. Wilson, what will you stop?"
Face whitening, Wilson turned from the pilot and stared out the wing, eyes like stone.
He glared back suddenly. "Rest assured, I will not say another word," he snapped.
"Mr. Wilson, try to understand our..." Wilson twisted away and stared out venomously at the engine. From a corner of his vision, he saw two passengers staring in the aisle looking at him.
"Idiots!" his mind exploded. He felt his hands began to tremble and for a few seconds was afraid that he was going to vomit. "It's the motion," he told himself. "The plane was bucking in the air now like a storm-tossed boat." He realized that the pilot was still talking to him, and refocusing his eyes, he looked at the man's reflection in the window. Beside him, mutely somber, stood the stewardess. "Blind idiots, both of them," thought Wilson. He did not indicate his notice of their departure. Reflected on the window, he saw them heading up toward the rear of the cabin.
"Well, they'll be discussing me now," he thought.
setting up plans in case I go violent. He wished now that the man would reappear, pull off the cowling plate, and ruin the engine. It gave him a sense of vengeful pleasure to know that only he stood between the catastrophe and the more than 30 people aboard. If he chose, he could allow the catastrophe to take place. Wilson smiled without humor. That would be a royal suicide, he thought. The little man dropped down again, and Wilson saw that what he thought was correct. The man had pressed the plate back into place before jumping away. For now, he was prying it up again and was raising easily, peeling back like skin excised by some grotesque surgeon. The motion of the wing was very broken, but the man seemed to have no difficulty staying balanced. Once more, Wilson felt panic. What was he to do? No one believed him. If he tried to convince them any more, they'd probably restrain him by force. If he asked the stewardess to sit by him, it would be at best only a momentary reprieve. The second she departed, or remaining, fell asleep, the man would return. Even if she stayed awake beside him, what was to keep the man from tampering with the engines on the other wing? Wilson shuddered, a coldness of dread misting along his bones. Dear God, there was nothing to be done. He twitched as, across the window through which he watched the little man, the pilot's reflection passed. The insanity of the moment almost broke him. The man and the pilot within feet of each other, both seen by him yet not aware of one another. No, 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 that was wrong. The little man had glanced across his shoulder as the pilot passed, as if he knew there was no need to leap off anymore, that Wilson's capacity for interfering was at an end. Wilson suddenly trembled with mind-searing rage. "I'll kill you," he thought. "You filthy little animal, I will kill you!" Outside, the engine faltered. It lasted only for a second, but in that second it seemed to Wilson as if his heart had also stopped. He pressed against the window, staring. The man had bent the cowling plate far back and was now on his knees, poking a curious hand into the engine. "Don't," Wilson heard the whimper of his own voice begging. "Don't." Again the engine faltered. Wilson looked about in horror. Was everyone deaf? He raised his hand to press the button for the stewardess and jerked his back. No, no, they'd just lock him up, restrain him somehow, and he was the only one who knew what was happening, the only one who could help. God. Wilson bit his lower lip until the pain made him whimper. He twisted around again and jolted. The stewardess was hurrying down the rocking aisle. She had heard it. He watched her fixedly and saw her glance at him as she passed his seat. She stopped three seats down the aisle. Huh. Yeah, someone else had heard. Wilson watched the stewardess. She leaned over, talking to the unseen passenger. Outside, the engine coughed again. Wilson jerked his head around and looked out with horror-pinched eyes. "Damn you," he whined. He turned again and saw the stewardess coming back up the aisle. She didn't look alarmed. Wilson stared at her with unbelieving eyes. It wasn't possible! He twisted around to follow her swaying motion and saw her turn in at the kitchen. No. Wilson was shaking so badly now he couldn't stop. No one had heard. No one knew. Suddenly, Wilson bent over and slid his overnight bag out from under the seat. Unzipping it, he jerked out his briefcase and threw it on the carpeting. Then, reaching in again, he grabbed the oilskin envelope and straightened up. From the corners of his eyes, he saw the stewardess coming back and pushed the bag beneath the seat with his shoes, shoving the oilskin envelope beside him. He sat there, rigidly, breath quavering in his chest as she went by. Then he pulled the envelope into his lap and untied it. His movements were so feverish that he almost dropped the pistol. He caught it by the barrel, then clutched at the stock with white-knuckled fingers and pushed off the safety catch. He glanced outside and felt himself grow cold. The man was looking at him. Wilson pressed his shaking lips together. It was impossible that the man knew what he intended. He swallowed and tried to catch his breath. He shifted his gaze to where the stewardess was handing some pills to the passenger ahead, then looked back at the wing. The man was turning to the engine once again, reaching in. Wilson's grip tightened on the pistol. He began to raise it. Suddenly, he lowered it. The window was too thick. The bullet might be deflected and kill one of the passengers. He shuddered and stared out at the little man. Again, the engine failed, and Wilson saw an eruption of sparks cast light against the man's animal features. He braced himself. There was only one answer. He looked down at the handle of the emergency door. There was a transparent cover over it. Wilson pulled it free and dropped it. He looked outside. The man was still there, crouched and probing at the engine with his hand. Wilson sucked in trembling breath. He put his left hand on the door handle and tested. It wouldn't move downward. Upward, there was play. Abruptly, Wilson let go and put the pistol in his lap. No time for argument, he told himself. With shaking hands, he buckled the belt across his thighs. When the ship was opened, there would be a tremendous rushing out of air. For the safety of the ship, he must not go with it. Now. Wilson picked up the pistol again, his heartbeat staggering. He'd have to be sudden, accurate. If he missed, the man might jump onto the other wing. Worse, onto the tail assembly, where, in violet, he could rupture wires, mangle flaps, destroy the balance of the ship. No. This was the only way. He'd fire low and try to hit the man in the chest or stomach. Wilson filled his lungs with air. Now, he thought, now! The stewardess came up the aisles. Wilson started pulling up the handle. For a moment, frozen in her steps, she could not speak. A look of stupefied horror distended her features, and she raised one hand as if imploring him. Then, suddenly, her voice was shrilling above the noise of the engines. Mr. Wilson, no! Get back, cried Wilson as he wrenched the handle up. The door seemed to disappear. One second it was by him in his grip. The next, with a hissing roar, it was gone. In the same instant, Wilson felt himself enveloped by a monstrous suction which tried to tear him from his seat. His head and shoulders left the cabin, and suddenly he was breathing tenuous, freezing air. For a moment, eardrums almost bursting from the thunder of the engines, eyes blinded by the arctic winds, he forgot the man. It seemed he heard a prick of screaming in the maelstrom that surrounded him, a distant shout. Then Wilson saw the man. He was walking across the wing, gnarled form leaning forward, talon twisted, hands outstretched in eagerness. Wilson flung up his arm, fired. The explosion was like a popping in the roaring violence of the air. The man staggered, lashed out, and Wilson felt a streak of pain across his head. He fired again at immediate range and saw the man go flailing backward, then suddenly disappear with no more solidity than a paper doll swept in a gale. Wilson felt a bursting numbness in his brain. He felt the pistol torn from failing fingers. Then all was lost in winter darkness. He stirred and mumbled. There was a warmness trickling in his veins. His limbs felt wooden. In the darkness, he could hear a shuffling sound, a delicate swirl of voices. He was lying, face up on something, moving, joggling. A cold wind sprinkled on his face. He felt the surface tilt beneath him. He sighed. The plane was landed, and he was being carried off in a stretcher, his head wound, likely plus an injection to quiet him. "Nuttiest way of trying to commit suicide I ever heard of," said a voice somewhere. Wilson felt the pleasure of amusement. Whoever spoke was wrong, of course, as would be established soon enough when the engine was examined and they checked his wound once more closely. Then they would realize that he had saved them all. Wilson slept without dreams. Nightmare at 20,000 Feet by Richard Matheson. This over WBAI in New York, which at the moment is sort of, well, 8 miles high.
miles high. And when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known. Signs in the street that say where you're going are somewhere just being their own.
If you would like to call up and discuss the work of Richard Matheson or Jack Vance or Ian M. Banks, all lost within the last couple of weeks, give us a call here at WBAI New York at 212-650-5782. We'll take calls after the birds. The program I'm using segues itself into my back pages. But hey, it's all good. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And we were just reading one of Richard Matheson's classic horror stories, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, filmed twice, both under the name Twilight Zone, once as a Twilight Zone episode with William Shatner playing Wilson, that's pre-Star Trek, and then former arts director of WBAI, John Lithgow, gave it a turn in the Twilight Zone movie directed by John Landis. And, Lithgow, really, he really did that one psychotically, brilliantly. That's a classic story. I mean, Duel was the one I was originally going to read, which was Steven Spielberg's first movie, by the way. And the story, is so magnificent. The end of the story, it's in Matheson's prose. I mean, he didn't just write these great, great stories. His prose puts you there. His writing gives a level to the fiction that all these great adaptations of his stuff failed to do. I'm going to look
at Duel on my tablet at the moment. And yes, I will get to your calls in just a moment. I see we have some coming in. But I want to read you the very, very, very last paragraph of Duel. Now, you probably know Duel. You may have seen the movie starring Dennis Weaver about a truck with an unseen driver, and the truck is trying to drive this car off the road and at all costs kill him. Now, it's a horror story in the classic tradition. There's no gore, there's no blood, there's not even a supernatural element as there was in Nightmare 20,000 Feet. There's just this elongated, amazing, tense story with fabulous scenes in the short story and in the Spielberg version. But one thing that's missing in the Spielberg version, the very last, I mean, of course, our protagonist named Man, like every man, Man, M-A-N-N, you know, wins, the truck goes over a cliff, spoilers, and boom, our protagonist wins. And but here's something that you don't get from the movie that you can only do in prose. The last paragraph reads, "Then, unexpectedly, emotion came. Not dread at first, and not regret, not the nausea that soon followed. It was a primeval tumult in his mind, the cry of some ancestral beast above the body of its vanquished foe." Ooh, that's nasty. That's a nice, lovely bit of nastiness that you can only find in prose. Whether it's the prose be spoken or whether it be read, you can't put that into a movie. You can't even put it into a radio drama without a narrator. And this, that little tidbit of kind of thing, is what drove writers like Stephen King to write horror. And all the others that write good horror, not, you know, limb-spouting, blood-gory, brain-eating guts. But the story that you heard, and this story, Duel, and all the rest of his amazing body of work, that's horror. Whether it is supernatural or not, it just captures you, absolutely captures you. And that last paragraph of Duel is what makes the story. Forget the 30 pages or so that come before that. That little tidbit, that last paragraph, which holds no spoilers, just that idea that here, this everyman kind of guy, our protagonist at the end, having won, turns into a beast. You know, with that visceral, primeval feeling to it. Ah, that's Matheson writing at his best. Good morning, you're on the air. No, you're not. You're a dial tone. Why are you a dial tone and on the air at the same time? That's ridiculous. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Well, that's a nice way to scare somebody who's about to take a flight.
There you go.
I have to tell you.
That's a DC-7. You're not taking a DC-7.
I don't think so. I can't tell anyway. Have you ever read his short story called Thirst?
Mm-hmm.
That starts out with the most, you know, innocuous. He wants to go get a drink of water. And where it winds up is just plain horror.
I mean, it's what he does. This is plain horror, but it's P-L-A-N-E.
Well, yes, I must tell you. Every time I take a flight, and I can't, by the way, you know how old a story this got to be. Stewardesses? When was the last time you heard those friendly folks referred to as stewardesses?
Actually, well within my lifetime. But, I mean, the story is early 50s at any rate.
And smoking on a plane?
Well, yeah, I remember smoking on planes. When I went to England last. Now that has to be, I will have quit smoking in this December 10 years ago, but it wasn't long before that. You could certainly smoke on a transatlantic flight.
They have smoking on transatlantic flights?
Absolutely, until about 10 years ago.
Oh, I thought all flights were, okay.
No. Flights that lasted up to a certain point. Flights under 6 hours, you could not smoke. Flights over 6 hours, you were allowed to smoke.
Is the entire flight smoking?
Sure.
Oh, I see. So it's not, you can't.
Well, not during takeoff and landing, but otherwise. And you had to sit in the smoking section or first class.
You know, the other story, of course, that I always think about when taking a flight or thinking about the Twilight Zone is, of course, Odyssey of Flight 33.
Yes, but that's not Matheson.
No. I didn't realize. How many Twilight Zone did you say he did? 16?
About 16, yes. And a lot of Alfred Hitchcock's and
Alfred Hitchcock?
Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and, you know, name it. He wrote it.
And he did all the TV and all the novels.
And a number of Roger Corman movies and a movie that just came out last year, you
and
know.
And he did the series of short story collections, I think, Shockwaves 1.
No, Shock. Just Shock. Shock, exclamation point. And then Shock 2, exclamation points. And Shock 3, exclamation points. Yes.
Dear. Well,
but, you know, he's got well over 12 collections of short stories.
Yes. And, of course, Third from the Sun, another classic.
Yeah.
Yes. By the way, then I'll let you go because I'm sure you have other calls.
Yeah.
Last week you sort of hung a question out. The upperclassman who was Kirk's nemesis on shore leave was
Flynn.
Finnegan.
Finnegan, not
Finnegan,
Flynn.
Like
Finnegan.
Wait. Yes.
Beginnigan.
Finnegan, whatever. By the way, just a quick question. What did you think of Into Darkness? I finally went to see it last night.
I loved the characters. I loved the characterizations. I thought the story sucked. Just like the first Star Trek movie.
Yeah, well, apparently there's going to be a third in this universe, I'm told.
Yes, but not by J.J. Abrams.
Isn't he doing Star Wars?
He's doing three Star Wars films.
Three
That's
Star
correct.
Wars, 7, 8, 9.
Oh, yeah.
Well. All right, see you next Tuesday.
Okay, take care. And, boy, there's some bizarre interference on our phones, isn't there? Yuck. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hi there. Turn down your radio, please.
Yeah. I'd like to say that the invasion of the body snatchers, when I used to watch the old early show, you remember the old early show years ago?
Mm-hmm.
On TV2?
Yeah.
And the movies they'd put on.
Yeah, but The Body Snatchers was written by Jack Finney.
That's what I remember.
Yeah.
Because the writer was Jack Benny.
Jack Finney, not Benny, Finney. F-I-N-N-E-Y, also author of Time and Again.
The which?
Time and Again, one of the great, great novels of science fiction.
Oh, he wrote that too?
Yes, he wasn't very prolific, but what he wrote was incredible.
Yeah, but no, I thought maybe he used a ghostwriter.
No, no.
No, actually,
Jack Finney is a great writer. He was no ghost.
Yeah, but no, you wouldn't know it from the TV show.
Jack Finney didn't write any TV shows.
No.
Are you confusing Jack Finney and Richard Matheson?
From his comedy show.
Jack Finney. Let me again spell it for you. F. Starts with an F. I-N-N-E-Y. Not B-E-N-N-Y.
No
connection.
You know why?
No connection between Jack Benny and Jack Finney. Two different people.
But when I saw it on the TV, they...
You've never seen Time and Again on TV. It's never been filmed. It's never been dramatized.
No.
It's a novel. Only a novel. He's never been on TV. You're confusing people.
Yeah, but no, when I thought that it was... I saw Jack Benny wrote it.
No, Jack Finney.
No, but they had Jack Benny.
No. Never.
So it wasn't Jack Benny that wrote that then?
No, for the third time. F-I-N-N-E-Y.
Yeah, no, because...
It's an F, not a B, okay?
Right.
Okay, thanks a lot. Have a good day. I mean, I can't say it too often, but we're on delay, so you can still hear it on the air if you listen real quick. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI, New York. We have about 7 minutes left. The telephone number here is 212-650-5782. What a bizarre phone number, but what a bizarre situation WBAI is in general. 212-650-7572. 650-5782. I'll never memorize that one. I remember WBAI phone numbers from 40 years ago. Absolutely. From more than 40 years ago, since I've been working here since 1967. but Oxford 7, I won't say it on the air, because every time I mention those old phone numbers on the air, somebody calls them. And they still exist, you know, they're assigned to other people now, calling in the middle of the night saying, I just heard this phone number on the radio. Yes, that was our phone number that many years ago, but no longer. But I remember at least five or six different phone numbers that were the WBAI phone numbers. Lister, turn on that fan. I turned it off because I was doing a reading and makes incredible noise in the air. But at this point, who cares about noise? We need air on the air. Once again, let me mention, this coming Tuesday, as Mr. Rodriguez, who called earlier, made reference to, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be featuring Kate Elliott from Hawaii. Oh, that's much better. I mean, the sound is worse, but the feeling of a little air moving. We can prop open the door, too. And E.C. Ambrose. This is the coming out party for E.C. Ambrose's first novel from Daw Books. Not first novel from Daw Books, her first novel, period. And if you take a look at the website where I have pictures, you will see that it is very specifically non-specific as to gender and all that. And E.C. Ambrose is the first novel by somebody who's written... Well, let's put it this way. We have Kate Elliott and E.C. Ambrose, and that's not the real name of either person. And no, Jack Benny did not write under the pseudonym Jack Finney, by the way. I just somehow couldn't believe that for a moment. Anyway, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will take place this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. Admission free, donations accepted. And it is at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street, located between Houston and the street formerly known as Prince. So I hope to see you there. I'll be the host and say hi when you show up. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hey, Jim, what a great reading that was.
Oh, I thought it was awful. There were parts in the middle that were okay, but I started miserably. And there were any... Oh, I was flubbing throughout.
Well, I did miss the beginning.
Good.
I started up late.
Don't listen to the archive. I was blathering. I'm off my feed tonight or something. And it started very haltingly... and flubs. And oh my God, this thing has typos. I downloaded it. I bought it online. And it is so riddled with typos. It's amazing.
It is an incredible story.
Oh, it's a great story.
You know, I've heard you say over the years how much you don't care for horror. But I'm thinking it must be a particular type of horror, like the graphic stuff that you don't go for.
Exactly. Today is what, the 65th anniversary of the publication of the short story The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. Now, you want to talk about great horror. You can't get much better than Shirley Jackson and stuff published in The New Yorker. But funny, hypocritical, I think, about horror. I used to fight with program directors, plural, and people at the station saying, no, science fiction is great literature. And they say, no, it isn't. It's trashy pulp stuff. And I'd say, well, what about 1984, Brave New World? And they'd say, that's not horror. That's literature.
Oh, my God.
Or that's not science fiction. And so I turn out to be the same kind of a snob when it comes to horror. It's like, oh, no, well, that's not horror, but it is.
Right. If it's good, it's not science fiction, it's literature.
Yes, God, exactly.
Annoying.
And
I've
so,
gotten into fights in bookstores over the...
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I got into, like, a screaming match in a bookstore many years ago at a bookstore, alas gone. It was called Science Fiction, Mysteries, and More on Chambers Street. And, you know, why did the guy come into the store if he wanted to fight about genre? But I...
because it's sometimes fun to do that.
Well, at least for him, I suppose. Not so much for me, but at any rate, it was a... my opinion of horror, I guess, has to change. And, it's splatter that I don't like, okay?
Got it. Gornography, all that stuff.
Gornography, that's the word. I read that once in a article in The Guardian written by some woman whose name I unfortunately have forgotten. And I thought that is such a great phrase, gornography. It really, really describes it perfectly well. But... that's it. It's that visceral gore, that the idea. I have no problem with, Clockwork Orange is certainly horror. And I don't have a problem with that. And it's certainly got violence. And I don't even necessarily have a problem with certain kinds of violence. But it's the splatter film and the visceral stuff that just is intended to make you think, oh my God, like the trailer of the movie Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I saw that when I was 8 years old and I still have nightmares about it. Not entertainment for me.
Well, I wanted to say I still haven't adjusted to the new schedule on this show. It's a real struggle.
Neither have I.
But I so enjoyed hearing that story, and I wanted you to know how much I appreciated that.
Well, thank you. And, of course, there's always the archive, and sooner or later, the podcast will happen. But I need somebody to help me build that website. Okay, thanks so much for listening.
Thanks, Jim.
I have to go out now. Have a good morning. Thanks for calling. Okay, well, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you again for listening. Please come next Tuesday to the reading. Find out more about the show, more about the readings. Go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com. And next week, well, as I said, I've got three major interviews lined up. By Tuesday, I'll be recording another. So hopefully it will be one of those. Also, another one, David Mercurio Rivera, whose book launching party is tomorrow. Got to deal with that. Anyhow, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming on these airwaves momentarily. Take care of yourselves. Good morning.
My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the country. Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
After 3 o'clock right here at 99 Sinker WBAI. Lister on the radar right here, where he belongs, burning the American imperialist flag to ashes before 5 o'clock when Al Jazeera English kicks in, free speech radio news kicks in, and at 6 o'clock Esther with a brand new wake up call. This is Burn Baby Burn, Lister Live 99 Sinker.
Life is so-
99 single is the life, What is Life, written by the great Ducky Simpson. The only good tune Ducky wrote, y'all. Yeah. Michael Rose on the case. Listen to this. Michael Rose tune is for you right here at 99 Single List Alive. Hey, featured in a movie called Pumping Iron with Grace Jones. You know that, right? And the Groper Neighbor. The Groper Neighbor. The Groper Neighbor. The Groper Neighbor. Drum and bass. Slide on bar. Robbie Shakespeare. You know it already. Yeah. Compass Point, the recording studio, back in the Bahamas. Back in the Bahamas, right? Yeah. Drum and bass. Love this tune. Taken from the album that's the greatest reggae album ever to get a Grammy, to the album that was robbed the Grammy when it came out, just like Sinead O'Connor's reggae album that was robbed the Grammy. This is John Brown's Body at the very best right here. List tonight.
Said we don't have another List 24 hours to waste. List we tonight. Dream of all that could be, but we just push it away. The more we think we're moving forward, we just keep in the pace with the light that's faded from the clouds. So listen to me shout. If you can afford a dollar to take care of the pain, you're gonna feel it and you're gonna beat it. No matter who you're gonna tell it to, I bet they won't hear you beg. It's your decision to be part of a solution today. So your beats are broken down, they can barely flow. I can't hold my tongue, we just let it